to feel the damp. And as the year waned, the sickness came to Dragonstone. It was not the sweating sickness, nor the shaking sickness, nor grayscale, Maester Culliper pronounced. The first sign was a bloody stool, followed by a terrible cramping in the gut. There were a number of diseases that could be the cause, he told the Queen. Which of those might be to blame, he never determined, for Culliper himself was the first to die, less than 2 days after he began to feel ill. Maester Anselm, who took his place, thought his age to blame. Culliper had been closer to 90 than to 80, and not strong. Casella Staunton was the next to succumb, however, and she was but 4 and 10. Then Septa Merriam sickened, and Elaine Royce, and even big, boisterous Sam Stokeworth, who liked to boast that she had never been sick a day in her life. All three died the same night, within hours of one another. Rhaena Targaryen herself remained untouched, though her friends and dear companions were being felled one by one. It was her Valyrian blood that saved her, Maester Anselm suggested. Ailments that carried off ordinary men in a matter of hours could not prevail against the blood of the dragon. Males also seemed largely immune to this queer plague. Aside from Maester Culliper, only women were struck down. The men of Dragonstone, be they knights, scullions, stable-boys, or singers, remained healthy. Queen Rhaena ordered the gates of Dragonstone closed and barred. As yet there was no sickness beyond her walls, and she meant for it to stay that way, to protect the small folk. When she sent word to King's Landing, Jaehaerys acted at once, commanding Lord Valyrian to send forth his galleys, to make certain no one escaped, to spread the pestilence beyond the island. The king's hand did as commanded, though not without grief, for his own young niece was amongst the women still on Dragonstone. Lyanna Valyrian died even as her uncle's galleys were pushing off from Driftmark. Maester Anselm had purged her, bled her, and covered her with ice, all to no avail. She died in Rhaena Targaryen's arms, convulsing as the queen wept bitter tears. "You weep for her," Andrew Farman said when he saw the tears on his wife's face. "But would you weep for me?" His words woke a fury in the queen. Lashing him across the face, Rhaena commanded him to leave her, declaring that she wanted to be alone. "You shall be," Andrew said. She was the last of them. Even then, so lost was the queen in her grief that she did not realize what had happened. It was Rigo Draz, the king's Pentoshi master of coin, who first gave voice to suspicion when Jaehaerys assembled his small council to discuss the deaths on Dragonstone. Reading over Maester Anselm's accounts, Lord Rigo furrowed his brow and said, "Sickness? This is no sickness. A weasel in the guts, dead in a day? This is the tears of Lys." "Poison?" King Jaehaerys said in shock. "We know more of such things in the free cities," Draz assured him. "It is the tears, never doubt it. The old maester would have seen it soon enough, so he had to die first. That is how I would do it. Not that I would. Poison is dishonourable." "Only women were struck down," objected Lord Valyrian. "Only women got the poison, then," said Rigo Draz. When Septon Barth and Grand Maester Bennifer concurred with Lord Rigo's words, the king dispatched a raven to Dragonstone. Once Rhaena Targaryen read his words, she had no doubt. Summoning the captain of her guards, she commanded that her husband be found and brought to her. Andrew Farman was not to be found in his bedchamber, nor the queen's, nor the great hall, nor the stables, nor the sept, nor Aegon's garden. In Sea Dragon Tower, in the maester's chambers under the rookery, they discovered Maester Anselm dead, with a dagger between his shoulder blades. With the gates closed and barred, there was no way to leave the castle save by dragon. "My worm of a husband does not have the courage for that," Rhaena declared. Andrew Farman was located at last in the chamber of the painted table, a long sword clutched in his grasp. He made no attempt to deny the poisonings. Instead, he boasted, "I brought them cups of wine, and they drank. They thanked me, and they drank." Why not? A cup-bearer, a serving man, that's how they saw me. Andrew the Sweet, Andrew the Jape. What could I do but fall off the dragon? Well, I could have done a lot of things. I could have been a lord. I could have made laws and been wise and given you counsel. I could have killed your enemies as easily as I killed your friends. I could have given you children. Rhaenyra Targaryen did not deign to reply to him. Instead, she spoke to her guards, saying, "Take him and geld him, but staunch the wound. I want his cock and balls fried up and fed to him. Do not let him die until he has eaten every bite." "No," Andrew Farman said, as they moved around the painted table to grasp him. "My wife can fly, and so can I." And so saying, he slashed ineffectually at the nearest man, backed to the window behind him, and leapt out. His flight was a short one, downward, to his death. Afterward, Rhaenyra Targaryen had his body hacked to pieces and fed to her dragons. His was the last notable death of 54 AC, but there was still more ill to come in that terrible year of the stranger. Just as a stone thrown into a pond will send out ripples in all directions, the evil that Andrew Farman had wrought would spread across the land, touching and twisting the lives of others long after the dragons were done feasting on his blackened, smoking remains. The first ripple was felt in the king's own small council, when Lord Daemon Valerian announced his desire to step down as Hand of the King. Queen Alyssa, it will be recalled, had been Lord Daemon's sister, and his young niece Lyanna had been amongst the women poisoned on Dragonstone. Some have suggested that rivalry with Lord Manfred Redwine, who had replaced him as Lord Admiral, played a part in Lord Daemon's decision, but this seems a petty aspersion to cast at a man who served so ably and so long. Let us rather take his lordship at his word, and accept that his advancing age, and a desire to spend his remaining days with his children and grandchildren on Driftmark, were the cause of his departure. Jaehaerys's first thought was to look to the other members of his council for Lord Daemon's successor. Albin Massey, Rhaego Draz, and Septon Barth had all shown themselves to be men of great ability, earning the king's trust and gratitude. None, however, seemed wholly suitable. Septon Barth was suspected of having greater loyalty to the Starry Sept than to the Iron Throne. Moreover, he was of very low birth. The great lords of the realm would never allow the son of a blacksmith to speak with the king's voice. Lord Rhaego was a godless Pentoshi, and an up-jumped spice-monger, and his birth was, if anything, even lower than Septon Barth's. Lord Albin, with his limp and twisted back, would strike the ignorant as somehow sinister. "They look at me and see a villain," Massey himself told the king. "I can serve you better from the shadows." There could be no question of bringing back Rhaegar Baratheon, nor any of King Maegor's surviving hands. Lord Tully's term upon the council during the regency had been undistinguished. Roderick Arryn, lord of the Eyrie and defender of the Vale, was a boy of 10, having come untimely into his lordship after the deaths of his uncle Lord Darnold and his sire Sir Rhymond, at the hands of the wildling raiders they had unwisely pursued into the Mountains of the Moon. Jaehaerys had but recently reached an understanding with Donal Hightower, but still did not entirely trust the man, no more than he did Lyman Lannister. Bertrand Tyrell, the Lord of Highgarden, was known to be a drunkard, whose unruly bastard sons would bring disgrace down on the crown if turned loose upon King's Landing. Alaric Stark was best left in Winterfell, a stubborn man, by all reports, stern and hard-handed and unforgiving, he would make for an uncomfortable presence at the council table. It would be unthinkable to bring an Iron Man to King's Landing, of course. With none of the great lords of the realm being found suitable, Jaehaerys next turned to their lords bannermen. It was thought desirable that the Hand be an older man, whose experience would balance the king's youth. As the council included several learned men of bookish inclination, a warrior was wanted as well, a man blooded and tested in battle, whose martial reputation would dishearten the crown's enemies. After a dozen names had been put forward and bandied about, the choice finally fell to Sir Miles Smallwood, Lord of Acorn Hall in the Riverlands, who had fought for the king's brother Aegon beneath the god's eye, battled Wat the Hewer at Stonebridge, and ridden with the late Lord Stokeworth to bring Harren the Red to justice during the reign of King Aenys. Justly famed for his courage, Lord Miles wore the scars of a dozen savage fights upon his face and body. Sir Willem the Wasp of the King's Guard, who had served at Acorn Hall, swore there was no finer, fiercer, or more leal lord in all the Seven Kingdoms, and Prentice Tully and the redoubtable Lady Lucinda, his liege lords, had naught but praise for Smallwood as well. Thus persuaded, Jaehaerys gave his assent, a raven took wing, and within the fortnight Lord Miles was on his way to King's Landing. Queen Alysanne played no part in the selection of the king's hand. Whilst the king and council were deliberating, Her Grace was absent from King's Landing, having flown Silverwing to Dragonstone to be with her sister and comfort her in her grief. Rhaena Targaryen was not a woman easily comforted, however. The loss of so many of her dear friends and companions had plunged her into a black melancholy, and even the mention of Andro Farman's name provoked her to fits of rage. Far from welcoming her sister and whatever solace she might bring, Rhaena thrice tried to send her away, even going so far as to scream at Her Grace in view of half the castle. When the queen refused to go, Rhaena retreated to her own chambers and barred the doors, emerging only to eat, and that less and less often. Left to her own devices, Alysanne Targaryen set about restoring a modicum of order to Dragonstone. A new maester was sent for and installed, a new captain appointed to take charge of the castle garrison. The queen's own beloved Scepter Edith arrived to assume the place of Rhaena's much-lamented Scepter Meriam. Shunned by her sister, Alysanne turned to her niece, but there too she encountered rage and rejection. "Why should I care if they're all dead? She'll find new ones, she always does," Princess Arya told the queen. When Alysanne tried to share stories of her own girlhood, and told of how Rhaena had put a dragon's egg into her cradle and cuddled and cared for her as if she were my mother, Arya said, "She never gave me an egg, she just gave me away and flew off to Fair Isle." Alysanne's love for her own daughter provoked the princess to anger as well. "Why should she be queen? I should be queen, not her." It was then that Arya broke down into tears at last, pleading with Alysanne to take her back with her to King's Landing. "Lady Alyssa said that she would take me, but she went away and forgot me. I want to come back to court, with the singers and the fools and all the lords and knights. Please take me with you." Moved by the girl's tears, Queen Alysanne could do no more than promise to take the matter up with her mother. When Rhaena next emerged from her chambers to take a meal, however, she rejected the notion out of hand. "You have everything, and I have nothing. Now you would take my daughter, too. Well, you shall not have her. You have my throne. Content yourself with that." That same night, Rhaena summoned Princess Arya to her chambers to berate her, and the sounds of mother and daughter shouting at one another rang through the stone drum. The princess refused to speak to Queen Alysanne after that. Stymied at every turn, Her Grace finally returned to King's Landing, to the arms of King Jaehaerys, and the merry laughter of her own daughter, Princess Daenerys. As the Year of the Stranger neared its end, work on the Dragon Pit was all but complete. The great dome in place at last, the massive bronze gates hung, the cavernous edifice dominated the city from the crown of Rhaenys' Hill, second only to the Red Keep upon Aegon's High Hill. To mark its completion and celebrate the arrival of the new hand, Lord Redwine proposed to the king that they stage a great tourney, the largest and grandest the realm had seen since the Golden Wedding. "Let us put our sorrows behind us, and begin the new year with pageantry and celebration," Redwine argued. The autumn harvests had been good. Lord Rigo's taxes were bringing in a steady stream of coin. Trade was on the increase, paying for the tourney would not be a concern, and the event would bring thousands of visitors, and their purses, to King's Landing. The rest of the council was all in favour of the proposal, and King Jaehaerys allowed that a tourney might indeed give the small folk something to cheer, and help us forget our woes. All such preparations were thrown into disarray by the sudden and unexpected arrival of Rhaena Targaryen from Dragonstone. It may well be that dragons somehow sense and echo the moods of their riders, Septon Barth wrote, for Dreamfire came down out of the clouds like a raging storm that day, and Vermithor and Silverwing rose up and roared at her coming, suchwise that all of us who saw and heard were fearful that the dragons were about to fly at one another with flame and claw, and tear each other apart as Beleriand once did to Quicksilver by the god's eye. The dragons did not, in the end, fight, though there was much hissing and snapping as Rhaenyra flung herself off Dreamfire and stormed into Maegor's Holdfast, shouting for her brother and her sister. The source of her fury was soon known. Princess Arya was gone. She had fled Dragonstone as dawn broke, stealing into the yards and claiming a dragon for her own. And not just any dragon. "Beleriand!" Rhaenyra exclaimed. "She took Beleriand, the mad child! No hatchling for her, no, not her. She had to have the Black Dread, Maegor's dragon, the beast that slew her father. Why him, if not to pain me? What did I give birth to? What kind of beast? I ask you, what did I give birth to?" "A little girl," Queen Alysanne said. "She is just an angry little girl." But Septon Barth and Grand Maester Bennifer tell us that Rhaenyra did not seem to hear her. She was desperate to know where her mad child might have fled. Her first thought had been King's Landing. Arya had been so eager to return to court. But if she was not here, where? "We will learn that soon enough, I suspect," King Jaehaerys said, as calm as ever. "Beleriand is too big to hide or pass unnoticed, and he has a fearsome appetite." He turned to Grand Maester Bennifer then, and commanded that ravens be sent forth to every castle in the Seven Kingdoms. "If any man in Westeros should so much as glimpse Beleriand or my niece, I want to know at once." The ravens flew, but there was no word of Princess Arya that day or the day after, or the day after that. Rhaenyra remained at the Red Keep all the while, sometimes raging, sometimes shaking, drinking sweet wine to sleep. Princess Daenerys was so frightened by her aunt that she cried whenever she came into her presence. After 7 days, Rhaenyra declared that she could no longer sit here idle. "I need to find her. If I cannot find her, at least I can look." So saying, she mounted Dreamfire and was gone. Neither mother nor daughter was seen or heard from again during what little remained of that cruel year. Jaehaerys and Alysanne, Their Triumphs and Tragedies. The accomplishments of King Jaehaerys I Targaryen are almost too many to enumerate. Chief amongst them, in the view of most students of history, are the long periods of peace and prosperity that marked his time upon the Iron Throne. It cannot be said Jaehaerys avoided conflict entirely, for that would be beyond the power of any earthly king. But such wars as he fought were short, victorious, and contested largely at sea or on distant soil. It is a poor king who wages battle against his own lords and leaves his own kingdom burned, bloody, and strewn with corpses, Septon Barth would write. His grace was a wiser man than that. Archmaesters can, and do, quibble about the numbers, but most agree that the population of Westeros north of Dorne doubled during the Conciliator's reign, whilst the population of King's Landing increased fourfold. Lannisport, Gulltown, Duskendale, and White Harbour grew as well, though not to the same extent. With fewer men marching off to war, more remained to work the land. Grain prices fell steadily throughout his reign as more acres came under the plough. Fish became notably cheaper, even for common men, as the fishing villages along the coasts grew more prosperous and more boats put to sea. New orchards were planted everywhere from the reach to the neck. Lamb and mutton became more plentiful, and wool finer, as shepherds increased the size of their flocks. Trade increased tenfold, despite the vicissitudes of wind, weather, and wars, and the disruptions they caused from time to time. The crafts flourished as well. Farriers and blacksmiths, stonemasons, carpenters, millers, tanners, weavers, felters, dyers, brewers, vintners, goldsmiths and silversmiths, bakers, butchers and cheesemakers all enjoyed a prosperity hitherto unknown west of the Narrow Sea. There were, to be sure, good years and bad years, but it was rightly said that under Jaehaerys and his queen, the good years were twice as good as the bad years were bad. Storms there were, and ill winds and bitter winters, but when men look back today upon the conciliator's reign, it is easy to mistake it for one long, green and gentle summer. Little of this would have been apparent to Jaehaerys himself as the bells of King's Landing rang to usher in the 55th year since Aegon's conquest. The wounds left by the cruel year that had gone before, the year of the stranger, were as yet too raw, and king, queen, and council alike feared what might lie ahead, with the princess Arya and Balerion still vanished from human ken, and Queen Rhaena gone in search of them. Having taken leave of her brother's court, Rhaena Targaryen flew to Old Town first, in the hopes that her wayward daughter might have sought out her twin sister. Lord Donnell and the High Septon each received her courteously, but neither had any help to offer. The queen was able to visit for a time with her daughter Rhaela, so like and yet so unlike her twin, and it can be hoped that she found some balm for her pain there. When Rhaena expressed regret that she had not been a better mother, the novice Rhaela embraced her and said, "I have had the best mother any child could wish for, the mother above, and you are to thank for her." Departing Old Town, Dreamfire took the Queen northward, first to Highgarden, then to Crake Hall and Casterly Rock, whose lords had welcomed her in days gone by. Nowhere had a dragon been seen, save for her own. Not even a whisper of Princess Arya had been heard. Thence Rhaena returned to Fair Isle, to face Lord Franklin Farman once again. The years had not made his lordship any fonder of the queen, nor any wiser in how he chose to speak to her. "I had hoped my lady sister might come home to do her duty once she fled from you," Lord Franklin said. "But we have had no word of her, nor of your daughter. I cannot claim to know the princess, but I would say she is well rid of you, as was Fair Isle. If she turns up here, we shall see her off, just as we did her mother." "You do not know, Arya. That much is true," Her Grace responded. "If she does indeed find her way to these shores, my lord, you may find she's not as forbearing as her mother. Oh, and I wish you luck if you should try to see off the Black Dread. Balerion quite enjoyed your brother. By now he may desire another course." After Fair Isle, history loses track of Rhaena Targaryen. She would not return to King's Landing or Dragonstone for the rest of the year, nor present herself at the seat of any lord in the Seven Kingdoms. We have fragmentary reports of Dreamfire being seen as far north as the Barrowlands and the banks of the Fever River, and as far south as the Red Mountains of Dawn and the canyons of the Torrentine. Shunning castles and cities, Rhaena and her dragon were glimpsed flying over the Fingers and the Mountains of the Moon, the misty green forests of Cape Wrath, the Shield Islands and the Arbor. But nowhere did she seek out human company. Instead, she sought the wild, lonely places, windswept moors and grassy plains and dismal swamps, cliffs and crags and mountain glens. Was she still hunting for some sign of her daughter? Or was it simply solitude she desired? We shall never know. Her long absence from King's Landing was for the good, however, for the king and his council were growing ever more vexed with her. The accounts of Rhaena's confrontation with Lord Farman on Fair Isle had appalled the king and his lords alike. "Is she mad to speak so to a lord in his own hall?" Lord Smallwood said. "Had it been me, I would have had her tongue out." To which the king replied, "I hope you would not truly be so foolish, my lord. Whatever else she may be, Rhaena remains the blood of the dragon, and my sister, whom I love." His Grace did not take issue with Lord Smallwood's point, it should be noted, only with his words. Septon Barth said it best. "The power of the Targaryens derives from their dragons, those fearsome beasts who once laid waste to Harrenhal and destroyed two kings upon the Field of Fire. King Jaehaerys knows this, just as his grandsire Aegon did. The power is always there, and with it the threat. His Grace also grasps a truth that Queen Rhaena does not, however. The threat is most effective when left unspoken. The lords of the realm are proud men all, and little is gained by shaming them. A wise king will always let them keep their dignity. Show them a dragon, aye, they will remember. Speak openly of burning down their halls, boast of how you fed their own kin to your dragons, and you will only inflame them and set their hearts against you. Queen Alysanne prayed daily for her niece Aria and blamed herself for the child's flight, but she blamed her sister more. Geharris, who had taken little note of Aria even during the years she had been his heir, chided himself now for that neglect. But it was Beleriand who most concerned him, for well he understood the dangers of a beast so powerful in the hands of an angry 13-year-old girl. Neither Rhaenyra Targaryen's fruitless wanderings nor the storm of ravens Grand Maester Bennifer sent forth had turned up any word of the princess or the dragon beyond the usual lies, mistakes, and delusions. As the days went by and the moon turned and turned again, the king began to fear that his niece was dead. "Valerian is a willful beast, and not one to be trifled with," he told the council. "To leap upon his back, never having flown before, and take him up, not to fly about the castle, no, but out across the water, like as not he threw her off, poor girl, and she lies now at the bottom of the narrow sea." Septon Bath did not concur. Dragons were not vagabond by nature, he pointed out. More oft than not, they find a sheltered spot, a cave or ruined castle or mountain top, and nest there, going forth to hunt and thence returning. Once free of his rider, Beleriand would surely have returned to his lair. It was his own surmise that, given the lack of any sightings of Beleriand in Westeros, Princess Aria had likely flown him east across the narrow sea to the vast fields of Essos. The queen concurred. "If the girl were dead, I would know it. She is still alive. I feel it." All the agents and informers that Rego Draz had engaged to hunt down Elissa Farman and the stolen dragon eggs were now given a new mission, to find Princess Aria and Beleriand. Reports soon began to come in from all up and down the narrow sea. Most proved useless, as with the dragon eggs, rumours, lies, and false sightings concocted for the sake of a reward. Some were third or fourth hand, others with such paucity of detail that they amounted to little more than, "I may have seen a dragon, or something big, with wings." The most intriguing report came from the hills of Andalus, north of Pentos, where shepherds spoke in fearful tones of a monster on the prowl, devouring entire flocks and leaving only bloody bones behind. Nor were the shepherds themselves spared, should they chance to stumble on this beast, for this creature's appetite was by no means limited to mutton. Those who actually encountered the monster did not live to describe him, however, and none of the stories mentioned fire, which Geharris took to mean that Beleriand could not be to blame. Nonetheless, to be certain, he sent a dozen men across the narrow sea to Pentos to try to hunt down this beast, led by Sir Willem the Wasp of his Kingsguard. Across that selfsame narrow sea, unbeknownst to King's Landing, the shipwrights of Braavos had completed work on the Carrick Sun Chaser, the dream Elissa Farman had purchased with her stolen dragon's eggs. Unlike the galleys that slid forth daily from the arsenal of Braavos, she was not oared. This was a vessel meant for deep waters, not bays and covers and inland shallows. Foremasted, she carried as much sail as the swan ships of the Summer Isles, but with a broader beam and deeper hull that would allow her to store sufficient provisions for longer voyages. When one Braavosi asked her if she meant to sail to Yi Ti, Lady Elissa laughed and said, "I may, but not by the route you think." The night before she was to set sail, she was summoned to the Sea Lord's palace, where the Sea Lord served her herring, beer, and caution. "Go with care, my lady," he told her, "but go. Men are hunting you all up and down the narrow sea. Questions are being asked, rewards are being offered. I would not care for you to be found in Braavos. We came here to be free of old Valyria, and your Targaryens are Valyrian to the bone. Sail far, sail fast." As the lady now known as Alice Westhill took leave of the Titan of Braavos, life in King's Landing continued as before. Unable to locate his lost niece, Geharris Targaryen proceeded as he always would in times of trouble, and gave himself over to his labours. In the quiet of the Red Keep's library, the king began work on what was to be one of the most significant of his achievements. With the able assistance of Septon Bath, Grand Maester Benifer, Lord Albin Massey and Queen Alisanne, a foursome his grace dubbed my even smaller council, Jehedis set out to codify, organize, and reform all the kingdom's laws. The Westeros that Aegon the Conqueror had found had consisted of 7 kingdoms in truth and not just name, each with its own laws, customs, and traditions. Even within those kingdoms there had been considerable variance from place to place. As Lord Massey would write, "Before there were 7 kingdoms, there were 8. Before that, 9, then 10, or 12, or 30, and back and back. We speak of the 100 kingdoms of the heroes when there were actually 97 at one time, 132 at another, and so on. The number forever changing as wars were lost and won and sons followed fathers. Oft as not, the laws changed as well. This king was stern. This king was merciful. This one looked to the 7-pointed star for guidance. This one held to the ancient laws of the first men. This one ruled by whim. T'other went one way when sober and another when drunk. After thousands of years, the result was such a mass of contradictory precedents that every lord possessed of the power of pit and gallows, and some who were not, felt free to rule however he might wish on any case that came before his seat. Confusion and disorder were offensive to Jehedis Targaryen, and with the help of his smaller council he set out to clean the stables. These 7 kingdoms have 1 single king. It is time they had a single law as well. A task so monumental would not be 1 year's work or 10's. Simply gathering, organizing, and studying the existing laws would require 2 years, and the reforms that followed would continue for decades. Yet here is where the great code of Septon Bath, who in the end would contribute thrice as much as any other man to the books of law that resulted, began, in that autumn year of 55 AC. The king's labours would continue for many years to come, the queen's for 9 turns of the moon. Early that same year, King Jaehaerys and the people of Westeros were thrilled to learn that Queen Alysanne was once again with child. Princess Daenerys shared their delight, though she told her mother in firm terms that she wanted a little sister. "You sound a queen already laying down the law," her mother told her, laughing. Marriages had long been the means by which the great houses of Westeros bound themselves together, a reliable method of forging alliances and ending disputes. Just as the Conqueror's wives had before her, Alysanne Targaryen delighted in making such matches. In 55 AC, she took particular pride in betrothals she arranged for 2 of the wise women who had served in her household since Dragonstone. Lady Jennys Templeton would wed Lord Mullendore of Uplands, whilst Lady Prunella Celtigar was joined in marriage to Uther Peake, Lord of Starpike, Lord of Dunstanbury, and Lord of Whitegrove. Both were considered exceptional matches for the ladies in question, and a triumph for the Queen. The tourney that Lord Redwine had proposed to celebrate the completion of the Dragon Pit was finally held at mid-year. Lists were raised in the fields west of the city walls between the Lion Gate and the King's Gate, and the jousting there was said to be especially splendid. Lord Redwine's eldest son, Sir Robert, showed his prowess with a lance against the best the realm had to offer, whilst his brother, Rickard, won the squire's tourney and was knighted on the field by the king himself. But the champion's laurels went to the gallant and handsome Sir Simon Dondarrion of Blackhaven, who won the love of the commons and queen alike when he crowned Princess Daenerys as his queen of love and beauty. No dragons had been settled in the Dragon Pit as yet, so that colossal edifice was chosen for the site of the tourney's grand melee, a clash of arms such as King's Landing had never seen before. 77 knights took part in 11 teams. The competitors began a horse, but once unhorsed continued on foot, battling with sword, mace, axe, and morning star. When all the teams but 1 had been eliminated, the surviving members of the final team turned on one another, until only a single champion remained. Though the participants bore only blunted, tourney weapons, the battles were hard-fought and bloody, to the delight of the crowds. Two men were killed, and more than 20 wounded. Queen Alisanne wisely forbade her favourites, Jonquil Dark and Tom the Strummer, from taking part, but the old Kegger Ale once more took the field to roars of approval from the commons. When he fell, the small folk found a new favourite in the up-jumped squire, Sir Harris Hogg, whose house name and pig's head helm earned him the style of Harry the Ham. Other notables who joined the melee included Sir Alan Bullock, late of Dragonstone, Rogar Baratheon's brothers, Sir Boris, Sir Garin, and Sir Ronald, an infamous hedge knight called Sir Guile the Cunning, and Sir Alistair Rain, champion of the Westerlands and master-at-arms at Casterly Rock. After hours of blood and clangour, however, the last man left standing was a strapping young knight from the Riverlands, a broad-shouldered blonde bull called Sir Lucamore Strong. Soon after the conclusion of the tourney, Queen Alisanne left King's Landing for Dragonstone, there to await the birth of her child. The loss of Prince Aegon after only 3 days of life still weighed heavily upon her grace. Rather than subject herself to the rigours of travel or the demands of life at court, the queen sought the quiet of the ancient seat of her house, where her duties would be few. Scepter Edith and Scepter Lyra remained by Alisanne's side, together with a dozen fresh young maidens chosen from amongst 100 who coveted the distinction of serving as a companion to the queen. 2 of Rogar Baratheon's nieces were amongst those so honoured, along with daughters and sisters of the Lords Arryn, Vance, Rowan, Royce, and Dondarrion, and even a woman of the North, Mara Manderly, daughter to Lord Theomore of White Harbour. To lighten their evenings, Her Grace also brought her favourite fool, the Goodwife, with his puppets. There were some at court who had misgivings about the Queen's desire to remove herself to Dragonstone. The island was damp and gloomy at the best of times, and in autumn strong winds and storms were common. The recent tragedies had only served to blacken the castle's reputation even further, and some feared that the ghosts of Rhaenyra Targaryen's poisoned friends might haunt its halls. Queen Alisanne dismissed these concerns as foolishness. "The king and I were so happy on Dragonstone," she told the doubters. "I can think of no better place for our child to be born." Another royal progress had been planned for 55 AC, this time to the Westerlands. Just as she had when carrying Princess Daenerys, the queen refused to let the king cancel or postpone the trip and sent him forth alone. Vermithor carried him across Westeros to the Golden Tooth, where the rest of his retinue caught up with him. From there, his grace visited Ashmark, the Crag, Case, Castamere, Tarbeck Hall, Lannisport, and Casterly Rock, and Crake Hall. Notable by its omission was Fair Isle. Unlike his sister Rhaena, Jaehaerys Targaryen was not a man given to making threats, but he had his own ways of making his disapproval felt. The king returned from the west a moon's turn before the queen was due, so he might be at her side when she delivered. The child came precisely when the maesters had said he would, a boy, clean-limbed and healthy, with eyes as pale as lilac. His hair, when it came in, was pale as well, shining like white gold, a colour rare even in Valyria of old. Jaehaerys named him Aemon. "Daenerys will be cross with me," Alisanne said, as she put the princeling to her breast. She was most insistent on wanting a sister. Jaehaerys laughed at that and said, "Next time." That night, at Alisanne's suggestion, he placed a dragon's egg in the prince's cradle. Thrilled by the news of Prince Aemon's birth, thousands of small folk lined the streets outside the Red Keep when Jaehaerys and Alisanne returned to King's Landing a moon's turn later, in hopes of getting a glimpse of the new heir to the Iron Throne. Hearing their chants and cheers, the king finally mounted the ramparts of the castle's main gate and raised the boy over his head for all to see. Then, it was said, a roar went up so loud that it could be heard across the narrow sea. As the Seven Kingdoms celebrated, word reached the king that his sister Rhaena had been seen again, this time at Greenstone, the ancient seat of House Estamont on the isle of the same name, off the shores of Cape Wrath. Here she decided to linger for a time. The very first of Rhaena's favourites, her cousin Larissa Valerian, had been married to the second son of the Even Star of Tarth, it may be recalled. Though her husband was dead, Lady Larissa had borne him a daughter, who had only recently been wed to the elderly Lord Estamont. Rather than remain on Tarth or return to Driftmark, the widow had chosen to stay with her daughter on Greenstone after the wedding. That Lady Larissa's presence drew Rhaena Targaryen to Estamont cannot be doubted, for the island was elsewise singularly lacking in charm, being damp, windswept, and poor. With her daughter lost to her, and her dearest friends and favourites in the grave, it should not be surprising that Rhaena sought solace with a companion of her childhood. It would have surprised and enraged the Queen to know that another former favourite was passing close to her at that very moment. After stopping at Pentos to take on supplies, Alice Westhill and her Sun Chaser had made their way to Tyrosh, with only the narrowest part of the narrow sea betwixt them and Estamont. The perilous passage through the pirate-infested waters of the Stepstones lay ahead, and Lady Alice was hiring crossbowmen and sellswords to see her safely through the straits to open water, as many a prudent captain did. The gods in their caprice chose to keep Queen Rhaena and her betrayer ignorant of one another, however, and the Sun Chaser passed through the Stepstones without incident. Alice Westhill discharged her hirelings on lease, taking on fresh water and provisions, before turning west and setting sail for Old Town. Winter came to Westeros in 56 AC, and with it grim news out of Essos. The men that King Jaehaerys had sent to investigate the great beast prowling the hills north of Pentos were all dead. Their commander, Ser Willem the Wasp, had engaged a guide in Pentos, a local who claimed to know where the monster lurked. Instead, he had led them into a trap, and somewhere in the velvet hills of Andalos, Ser Willem and his men had been set upon by brigands. Though they had given a good account of themselves, the numbers were against them, and in the end they were overwhelmed and slain. Ser Willem had been the last to fall, it was said. His head had been returned to one of Lord Rigo's agents in Pentos. "There is no monster," Septon Barth concluded after hearing the sad tale. "Only men stealing sheep and telling tales to frighten other men away." Miles Smallwood, the king's hand, urged the king to punish Pentos for the outrage, but Jaehaerys was unwilling to make war upon an entire city for the crimes of some outlaws. So the matter was put to rest, and the fate of Ser Willem the Wasp was inscribed in the White Book of the King's Guard. To fill his place, Jaehaerys awarded a white cloak to Ser Lucamor Strong, the victor of the great melee in the Dragon Pit. More news soon came from Lord Rigo's agents across the water. One report spoke of a dragon being displayed in the fighting pits of Astapor on Slaver's Bay, a savage beast with shorn wings the slavers set against bulls, cave bears, and packs of human slaves armed with spears and axes, whilst thousands roared and shouted. Septon Barth dismissed the account at once. "A wyvern, beyond a doubt," he declared. "The wyverns of Sothorius are oft taken for dragons by men who have never seen a dragon." Of far more interest to the king and council was the great fire that had swept across the disputed lands a fortnight past. Fanned by strong winds and fed by dry grasses, the blaze had raged for 3 days and 3 nights, engulfing half a dozen villages and one free company, the adventurers, who found themselves trapped between the onrushing flames and a Tyroshi host under the command of the Archon himself. Most had chosen to die upon Tyroshi spears, rather than be burned alive. Not a man of them had survived. The source of the fire remained a mystery. "A dragon," Sir Miles Smallwood declared. "What else could it be?" Rigo Dras remained unconvinced. "A lightning strike," he suggested. "A cook fire. A drunk with a torch looking for a whore." The king agreed. If this were Beleriand's doing, he would surely have been seen. The fires of Essos were far from the mind of the woman calling herself Alice Westhill in Old Town. Her eyes were fixed upon the other horizon, on the storm-lashed western seas. Her Sun Chaser had come to port in the last days of autumn, yet still she lingered at dockside as Lady Alice searched for a crew to sail her. She was proposing to do what only a handful of the boldest mariners had ever dared attempt before— to sail beyond the sunset in search of lands undreamed of, and she did not want men aboard who might lose heart rise up against her and force her to turn back. She required men who shared her dream, and such were not easily found, even in Old Town. Then, as now, ignorant small folk and superstitious sailors clung to the belief that the world was flat, and ended somewhere far to the west. Some spoke of walls of fire and boiling seas, some of black fogs that went on forever, some of the very gates of hell. Wiser men knew better. The sun and moon were spheres, as any man with eyes could see. Reason suggested that the world must be a sphere as well, and centuries of study had convinced the archmaesters of the conclave that there could be no doubt of that. The dragon lords of the freehold of Valyria had believed the same, as did the wise of many distant lands from Karth to Yi-Ti to the Isle of Lung. The same accord did not exist as regards the size of the world. Even amongst the archmaesters of the Citadel there was deep division on that question. Some believed the sunset sea to be so vast that no man could hope to cross it. Others argued it might be no wider than the summer sea where it stretched from the arbour to Great Morak. A tremendous distance, to be sure, but one that a bold captain might hope to navigate with the right ship. A western route to the silks and spices of Yi-Ti and Lung could mean incalculable riches for the man who found it, if the sphere of the world was as small as these wise men suggested. Alice Westhill did not believe it was. The scant writings she left behind show that even as a child Elissa Farman was convinced the world was far larger and far stranger than the maesters imagine. Not for her the merchant's dream of reaching Ulthos and Ashai by sailing west. Hers was a bolder vision. Between Westeros and the far eastern shores of Essos and Ulthos, she believed, lay other lands and other seas waiting to be discovered. Another Essos, another Sothorios, another Westeros. Her dreams were full of sundering rivers and wind-swept plains and towering mountains with their shoulders in the clouds, of green islands verdant in the sun, of strange beasts no man had tamed, and queer fruits no man had tasted, of golden cities shining underneath strange stars. She was not the first to dream this dream. Thousands of years before the conquest, when the kings of winter still reigned in the north, Brandon the shipwright had built an entire fleet of ships to cross the Sunset Sea. He took them west himself, never to return. His son and heir, another Brandon, burned the yards where they were built, and was known as Brandon the Burner forevermore. 1,000 years later, iron men sailing out from Great Wick were blown off course onto a cluster of rocky islands 8 days' sail to the northwest of any known shore. Their captain built a tower and a beacon there, took the name of Farwind, and called his seat the Lonely Light. His descendants lived there still, clinging to rocks where seals outnumbered men 50-1. Even the other iron men considered the Farwinds mad. Some named them Selkies. Brandon the shipwright and the ironborn who came after him had both sailed the northern seas, where monstrous krakens, sea dragons and leviathans the size of islands swam through cold grey waters, and the freezing mists hid floating mountains made of ice. Alice Westhill did not intend to voyage in their wake. She would sail her sun chaser on a more southerly course, seeking warm blue waters and the steady winds she believed would carry her across the Sunset Sea. But first she had to have a crew. Some men laughed at her, whilst others called her mad, or cursed her to her face. "Strange beasts, aye," one rival captain told her, "and like as not you'll end up in the belly of one." A good portion of the gold that the Sea Lord had paid for her stolen dragon's eggs reposed safely in the vaults of the Iron Bank of Braavos, however, and with such wealth behind her, Lady Alice was able to tempt sailors by paying thrice the wages other captains could offer. Slowly she began to gather willing hands. Inevitably, word of her efforts came to the attention of the Lord of the Hightower. Lord Donald's grandsons, Eustace and Norman, both noted mariners in their own right, were sent to question her, and clap her in fetters if they felt it prudent. Instead, both men signed on with her, pledging their own ships and crews to her mission. After that, sailors clambered over one another in their haste to join her crew. If the high towers were going, there were fortunes to be had. The Sun Chaser departed Old Town on the 23rd day of the third moon of 56 AC, making her way down Whispering Sound for the open seas in company with Sir Norman Hightower's Autumn Moon and Sir Eustace Hightower's Lady Meredith. Their departure came not a day too soon, for word of Alice Westhill and her desperate search for a crew had finally reached King's Landing. King Jaehaerys saw through Lady Alyssa's false name at once, and immediately sent ravens to Lord Donnell in Old Town, commanding him to take this woman into custody and deliver her to the Red Keep for questioning. The birds came too late, however. Or mayhaps, as some suggest, even to this day, Donnell the Delayer delayed again. Unwilling to risk the king's wrath, his lordship dispatched a dozen of his own swiftest ships to chase down Alice Westhill and his grandsons, but one by one they straggled back to port defeated. Seas are vast, and ships small, and none of Lord Donnell's vessels could match the Sun Chaser for speed when the wind was in her sails. When word of her escape reached the Red Keep, the king pondered long and hard on chasing after Alyssa Farman himself. No ship can sail as swiftly as a dragon flies, he reasoned. Mayhaps Vermithor could find her where Lord Hightower's ships could not. The very notion terrified Queen Alysanne, however. Even dragons cannot stay aloft forever, she pointed out, and such charts as existed of the sunset sea showed neither islands nor rocks to rest upon. Grand Maester Benefer and Septon Bath concurred, and against their opposition, his grace reluctantly put the idea aside. The 13th day of the fourth moon of 56 AC dawned cold and grey, with a blustery wind blowing from the east. Court records tell us that Jaehaerys I Targaryen broke his fast with an envoy of the Iron Bank of Braavos, who had come to collect the annual payment on the crown's loan. It was a contentious meeting. Alyssa Farman was still very much in the king's thoughts, and he had certain knowledge that her Sun Chaser had been built in Braavos. His grace demanded to know if the Iron Bank had financed the building of the ship, and whether they had any knowledge of the stolen dragon eggs. The banker, for his part, denied all. Elsewhere in the Red Keep, Queen Alysanne spent the morning with her children. Princess Daenerys had finally warmed to her brother Aemon, though she still wanted a little sister. Septon Bath was in the library, Grand Maester Benefer in his rookery. Across the city, Lord Corbray was inspecting the men of the east barracks of the city watch, whilst Rigo Draz entertained a young lady of negotiable virtue in his manse below the dragon pit. All of them would long remember what they were doing when they heard the blast of a horn ringing through the morning air. The sound of it ran down my spine like a cold knife, the Queen would say later, though I could not have said why. In a lonely watchtower overlooking the waters of Blackwater Bay, a guard had glimpsed dark wings in the distance and sounded the alarm. He sounded the horn again as the wings grew larger, and a third time when he saw the dragon plane, black against the clouds. Balerion had returned to King's Landing. It had been long years since the Black Dread had last been seen in the skies above the city, and the sight filled many a Kingslander with dread, wondering if somehow Maegor the Cruel had returned from beyond the grave to mount him once again. Alas, the rider clinging to his neck was not a dead king, but a dying child. Balerion's shadow swept across the yards and halls of the Red Keep as he came down, his huge wings buffeting the air, to land in the inner ward by Maegor's holdfast. Scarcely had he touched the ground than Princess Arya slid from his back. Even those who had known her best during her years at court scarce recognized the girl. She was near enough to naked as to make no matter, her clothing no more than rags and tatters clinging to her arms and legs. Her hair was tangled and matted, her limbs as thin as sticks. "Please," she cried to the knights and squires and serving men who had seen her descend. Then, as they came rushing toward her, she said, "I never," and collapsed. Sir Lucamore Strong had been at his post on the bridge across the dry moat surrounding Maegor's holdfast. Shoving aside the other onlookers, he lifted the princess in his arms and carried her across the castle to Grand Maester Benefer. Later he would tell anyone who would listen that the girl was flushed and burning with fever, her skin so hot he could feel it even through the enameled scale of his armour. She had blood in her eyes as well, the knight claimed, and there was something inside her, something moving, that made her shudder and twist in my arms. He did not tell these tales for long, though. The next day King Jaehaerys sent for him and commanded him to speak no more of the princess. The king and queen were sent for at once, but when they reached the maester's chambers, Bennifer denied them entry. "You do not want to see her like this," he told them, "and I would be remiss if I allowed you any closer." Guards were posted at the door to keep servants away as well. Only Septon Bath was admitted to administer the rites for the dying. Bennifer did what he could for the stricken princess, giving her milk of the poppy and immersing her in a tub of ice to bring her fever down, but his efforts were to no avail. Whilst hundreds crowded into the Red Keep's sept to pray for her, Jaehaerys and Alysanne kept vigil outside the maester's door. The sun had set, and the hour of the bat was at hand, when Barth emerged to announce that Arya Targaryen was dead. The princess was consigned to the flames the very next day at sunrise, her body wrapped in fine white linen from head to toe. Grand Maester Bennifer, who had prepared her for the funeral pyre, looked half-dead himself, Lord Redwine confided to his sons. The king announced that his niece had died of a fever, and asked the realm to pray for her. King's Landing mourned for a few days before life resumed as before, and that was the end of it. Mysteries remain, however. Even now, centuries later, we are no closer to knowing the truth. More than 40 men have served the Iron Throne as Grand Maester. Their journals, letters, account books, memoirs, and court calendars are our single best record of the events they witnessed, but not all of them were equally diligent. Whereas some left us volumes of letters full of empty words, never failing to note what the king ate for supper and whether he enjoyed it, others set down no more than a half-dozen missives a year. In this regard, Bennifer ranks near the top, and his letters and journals provide us with detailed accounts of all that he saw, did, and witnessed whilst in service to King Jaehaerys and his uncle Maegor before him. And yet in all of Bennifer's writings, there is not a single word to be found concerning the return of Arya Targaryen and her stolen dragon to King's Landing, nor the death of the young princess. Fortunately, Septon Barth was not so reticent, and it is to his own account we must now turn. Barth wrote, "It has been 3 days since the princess perished, and I have not slept. I do not know that I shall ever sleep again. The mother is merciful, I have always believed, and the Father above judges each man justly. But there was no mercy and no justice in what befell our poor princess. How could the gods be so blind or so uncaring as to permit such horror? Or is it possible that there are other deities in this universe, monstrous, evil gods such as the priests of Red Valor preach against whose malice the kings of men and the gods of men are naught but flies? I do not know. I do not want to know. If this makes me a faithless septon, so be it. Grand Maester Bennifer and I have agreed to tell no one all of what we saw and experienced in his chambers as that poor child lay dying. Not the king, nor the queen, nor her mother, nor even the archmaesters of the citadel. But the memories will not leave me, so I shall set them down here. Mayhaps by the time they are found and read, men will have gained a better understanding of such evils. We have told the world that Princess Arya died of a fever, and that is broadly true, but it was a fever such as I have never seen before and hope never to see again. The girl was burning. Her skin was flushed and red, and when I laid my hand upon her brow to learn how hot she was, it was as if I had thrust it into a pot of boiling oil. There was scarce an ounce of flesh upon her bones, so gaunt and starved did she appear. But we could observe certain swellings inside her, as her skin bulged out and then sunk down again, as if— no, not as if, for this was the truth of it. There were things inside her, living things, moving and twisting, mayhaps searching for a way out, and giving her such pain that even the milk of the poppy gave her no surcease. We told the king, as we must surely tell her mother, that Arya never spoke. but that is a lie. I pray that I shall soon forget some of the things she whispered through her cracked and bleeding lips. I cannot forget